From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director Alan Rudolph. His credits include Choose Me and Welcome to L.A. His new film, Made in Heaven, stars Timothy Hutton and Kelly McGillis, and opens this week. Also today, I talk with Lar Lubavitch, choreographer for the new Stephen Sondheim musical, Into the Woods. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of contemporary Chinese music performed by pianist Jeffrey Jacobs. And Jan-Harald Brunvand is back with another urban legend, this one about a couple of strangers who end up inadvertently sharing a meal. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The new movie, Made in Heaven, starring Timothy Hutton and Kelly McGillis, opens this week. My guest is the director of the film, Alan Rudolph. Made in Heaven is a major motion picture with all the trimmings, big budget, top stars, and that's a departure from the kind of quirky, personal films Rudolph usually likes to make. His films Choose Me and Trouble in Mind are both dreamlike with drizzly, neon-lit atmospheres. They're set in seedy bars and rundown diners with drifters, tough women, and other characters far out of the mainstream. They're dark films with a comic edge. Rudolph broke into the film industry working as Robert Altman's assistant director. Altman produced Rudolph's first two films, Welcome to L.A. and Remember My Name. Since then, Rudolph has maintained something of a dual career, writing and directing his own movies, while also directing studio-produced films like Songwriter, Roadie, and Endangered Species, none of which turned out to be big box office successes. I spoke with Alan Rudolph earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. He told me how he was offered the chance to direct Made in Heaven.
After Choose Me, I was used to making films that A, nobody either saw, or B, they saw and didn't care about. And I'd never been sent any screenplays. It didn't bother me because I like to do my own. And after Choose Me, I was in Seattle shooting Trouble in Mind, and Choose Me and Songwriter had come out at the same time. Songwriter was a film I did immediately following Choose Me. And apparently they started to cause some attention in Los Angeles, and I got sent some scripts. And Made in Heaven was the first one I read, and then after I read about four or five, I thought that was enough. And I tried to get The Moderns done, which is a film I've been trying to do for 12 years, and I said I wasn't really interested in doing anybody else's work, but I couldn't get The Moderns started, so we took this to a studio, and they said yes.
When you were making Made in Heaven, was there ever a voice in the back of your head saying, this is a major motion picture, you can't be as quirky, it's not solely your film, and you can't take the chances that you usually do?
Well, that wasn't a little voice, that was a loudspeaker right in front of my face. I'd made four movies for studios. I haven't had any luck with distribution. This should be the best distributed film on that level I've made. But, you know, there's a built-in compromise, basically, for someone like me, because I've also had the privilege of doing six films on my own where there was nobody to tell me anything other than to support what I was trying to do. But once you've been around this process a couple times, you know that going in. And the best thing about Made in Heaven was it, if you could just execute what was there, it was okay with me and it was okay with them. It was sort of a bargain we had struck with each other, them being the studio. But I probably on my own would have made it a little darker and weirder. But in some ways I'm glad I wasn't allowed to do that.
Why?
Well, because I think it's, you know, that would have meant fewer people would have been interested and it would have been more tumbleweeds in front of the theater, you know. And I think this is a real nice movie that should be seen by people who care about themselves, and I didn't really want to scare anybody away.
Well, I think you still managed to make it a very personal film. And let me just tell a little bit about the story. Timothy Hutton and Kelly McGillis play two people who fall in love in heaven. And on the day of their wedding, she's sent back to Earth as a baby, and he begs to be sent to Earth, too, so that he can find her again. And he is, but there's no guarantee that he'll ever find her or that they'll recognize each other if they do. And if they don't find each other by their 30th birthdays, they'll never meet and they'll never find happiness. And consequently, the movie is always hovering between the sense of magic and the sense of despair and loss.
Just hearing you repeat the storyline sounds like hard news to me. It's a Hollywood fable, you know, and in the best tradition, and I think the best of those films were made in the 40s, so the film has a kind of a 40s sensibility. But I was really interested I'm only interested in the human factor in anything, and I'm not real good at giving you mayhem and murder on screen, because I really want to know what's going on in their minds more than in their guns, you know. But this one was about, we call it the Rambo of romance. It was really a romantic film with that dead center and not pushed to the side while some hard plot was taking place. And, you know, the budget wasn't that big. I mean, it was big for me, but not by Hollywood standards. It was actually about $4 or $5 million less than what the average film cost. It was made for $10 million, which you and I could have a lot of fun on, but... when you do a studio film, that's not a lot of money.
You know, I got the impression from the movie that you found the pleasures of heaven just slightly dull because there's no tension, there's no suffering that leads to the pleasures, and that you probably preferred the rough and tumble chaos of Earth.
Well, heaven to me is the setup in this story. You know, I mean, it's obviously you can't do any research, and whatever version you come up with is valid, because who knows if the place even exists. But you're accurate there. I was more at home in this hellish earth than I was in heaven. But the thing I like about our version of heaven is that it's not all floating around in clouds. I mean, you can have a beer, you can make love, you can go to a movie, you can do whatever you want. And there was a purpose to your occupation in heaven, which is to find new ideas so you could do something. And but the film is just a dream to me. I mean, all films are dreams, and making them is rather dreamlike too, but this one is really a fantasy, which is not an easy thing to do, because you know, once you capture it, it's there permanently. And the script was loaded with special effects and all that, and I don't really want to do that. I'm not interested in it, and I didn't want to find myself in a moment with an intimate moment with the two actors in front of a blue screen, you know, and say, imagine that you're tumbling through clouds, you know. I couldn't see myself doing that, so we tried to do some of the touches in heaven like they do in theater, where the magic and the mystery is partially on the audience's imagination. But the shooting of it was kind of confusing, because we weren't allowed to do it in continuity because of production requirements and restrictions. So we'd be shooting a scene 1946 before lunch, and a heaven thing right after lunch, and something in 1972 before we wrapped, and everyone was confused all the time. I'm still confused.
My guest is film director Alan Rudolph, and he did the films Welcome to L.A., Choose Me, Trouble in Mind. His new movie, Made in Heaven, opens this week. Now, as the American public is about to see your new movie, Made in Heaven, you're about to put the finishing touches on a movie that you've been working on off and on for 12 years, the movie you referred to a few minutes ago, The Moderns, which is about artists in Paris in the 1920s. And that movie features actors who've become almost your repertory company, Keith Carradine, Genevieve Bugeaud. What are some of the advantages for you as a director to work with the same actors on a number of movies, so that you really know them intimately?
Well, that's the reason. It's like any other good relationship. I mean, when you first meet people or first work with people, and Made in Heaven was kind of interesting because I'd never worked with any of the cast before, and it's a great cast. But it takes a while to learn your style, your processes, your fears, how far the trust goes before it turns into suspicion. And I think a lot of acting and the relationship between actors and directors really is primarily should be built on trust. But Keith and I have now done 4 movies together. And it's almost eye contact tells each other what the other wants, you know. And Genevieve, who the first time I worked with her in Choose Me is now, and this was her 3rd film with me. And Geraldine Chaplin's in it, whom I worked with twice before. And it's really interesting because they predict what you want, or at least guess at it. And I'm a kind of filmmaker who leaves a lot open to interpretation for the very moment we're doing it. I don't really like to have anything too well planned except for the purpose of what we're trying to do. And I work with some excellent actors on the same film who I've never worked with, so it was an interesting combination.
Now, Genevieve Bigeau and especially Keith Carradine never seemed to work much outside of your movies. And I don't know whether that's through choice or something else.
Well, actually, Keith works all the time. He does a lot of television movies, and he's done quite a bit of features. Oh. He's one of those very underrated, almost invisible actors because he changes for every role, and he doesn't live the Hollywood persona. You know, he's got a couple of kids and a nice wife, and is really a very, very down to earth person. I really am fond of him. But he's been in a few films with Walter Hill. He was in a Louis Malle film. He's a couple of Altmans, Ridley Scott's first film. He works quite a bit. Also in the film is John Lone, who is the star of the new Bertolucci film, The Last Emperor, and Linda Fiorentino, who is probably most remembered for After Hours, and Wallace Shawn, who is a terrific actor. But he's not really an actor.
He's really a playwright.
He's one of those unique individuals who doesn't have to know everything to be able to do everything. And he was at my dinner with Andre, and a real good young actor named Kevin J. O'Connor, who plays Hemingway in our movie. So it was a wonderful mix of actors.
You met, I think, Keith Carradine while working with Robert Altman.
Mm-hmm.
You were Altman's protege for a while
Hollywood, right? I hired on as his protege. It said protege wanted to apply here.
Do you hate it when people say that?
I never knew what it meant. I mean, I always assumed it was their problem, not mine. It was a thrill working with Altman. I mean, I still see him every now and then. I have nothing but regard and respect and fondness. And I mean, I think he is like most great American resources, which is underappreciated and threatened with endangerment. But it was a real fertile time.
Well, you were working with him as an assistant director. Did you have that? Were you an assistant director with other directors before working with him?
Right. I had been an assistant director for a few years. I went through a training program and became one rather quickly and could see instantly it was something that I wasn't going to do for a long time. And then I wrote a lot of screenplays to try and get them done. It was a good way to. It's the cheapest way to make movies, you know, write a screenplay and Xerox it. And nothing ever happened, but I learned what I wanted to do. And I hadn't been an assistant director for many years, and his organization called me and asked me if I wanted to work. And I didn't at first, and then I saw McCabe and Miss Miller, and I thought, okay, whatever you want me to do. Then I wrote something for him, and he produced my first 2 films, Welcome to L.A. and Remember My Name.
What was he doing on the set different from other directors who you'd worked with?
Well, that's the thing with Bob. He doesn't teach you anything, but you learn a lot if you're watching. He goes from A to Z so gracefully that it's almost an invisible process, how he works. He, over the years, has developed his own techniques that completely coincide with his point of view, so it seems really effortless. And he, you know, obviously leaves a lot open for spontaneity, which is something that I really responded to because in my own imagination, if I ever got to shoot a film, I wanted to do that myself.
Well, are you referring to, like, improvisation?
Yeah, but it's never, you know, that's, I think pure improvisation is you get 2 actors, you put them in a set and tell them what the situation is, walk away and turn on the camera. I mean, it's never really like that. It's a rehearsed improvisation, if there's such a thing, where I seem to be able to write pretty good on my feet, where I say, well, why don't you say this, and you say this, and then somebody... but if you don't want to say that, say something else, and then people like Wally Shawn or Keith or something will come up with a very funny line, and you just keep going. But Bob has, even down to how where he puts his camera and how he goes about the technical side is so effortless that it's very deceiving to watch him work.
Were you able to use any of that open-ended style with Made in Heaven?
Yeah, we did that a lot. Tim is, you know, he'd been... One of the misfortunes of Hollywood is that typecasting becomes, you know, I mean, it's one of the prejudices of a monolithic structure, you know, and because Tim had done very serious films and hadn't done anything light and romantic, people assumed he couldn't do it. But when I first met him, he's very funny, a very charming person, and very inventive. And I mean, we just spent the night last night here in New York, and we just laughed all night long. He's so funny. He's like jazz. I mean, you can give him something to start with, and he'll go off on his own and come back in the same theme. And it was a real thrill working with him. I think he and Kelly are simply two of the best actors working today. And in a film that is very romantic and rather ethereal in its concept, and Kelly plays a new soul, so to speak, who's never even been to Earth. It would have been easy to, in the wrong hands, to make it not such a dense experience. But I think someone like Kelly has such intelligence that you can see her thoughts, even if you don't know what they are, and that really helped. And I was thrilled working with them, but it took a while for them to get used to how I work. And I think both of them really responded. I was very pleased.
Initially, they wanted more structure?
Well, no, I think it's, again, a matter of trust. There's a great quote, I don't know who said it, it's that making movies is like making love. You're never sure how the other guy does it, you know? And I just do what I do, but when people come on the set, you get the summary of their whole experience, and you start to realize that... films are made in a rather structured way, with so much of the life has been squeezed out of it already, you know. And to me, a screenplay is as important to anybody else, but it's not the final word by any stretch. And if you hire an actor, it's like hiring another writer, and certainly a collaborator. And I open up to ideas from almost anybody, but I also refuse the right to accept them. But and with actors, they're such a smart breed of people and crazy that their ideas are usually sensational, and I'm always saying, geez, well, let's use that. I'll take credit for it later.
I want to talk with you more about your movies, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is film director and screenwriter Alan Rudolph, and his movies include Welcome to L.A., Choose Me, and Trouble in Mind. He directed the new movie, Made in Heaven, that stars Timothy Hutton and Kelly McGillis. It opens this week. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director and screenwriter Alan Rudolph is my guest. One of the things I've heard that you do on the set, which struck me as very intriguing and very unusual, and maybe it's not right, maybe you don't really do this, but I'd read you sometimes just play music as actors are doing a scene so that the music will help transfer the mood.
I do that. I'm sure I'd be arrested if there were laws against such things, but most of my films are not plot oriented. They're really about behavior. The characters lead the story instead of the story leading the characters. And music seems to be the number one tool to create a mood. And mood and behavior seem to go hand in hand. And on this film, which there's so much of it that was atmospheric, you know, even though there was a story going on, Heaven was definitely a place that was dominated by mood. And Mark Isham, who is such a magnificent musical thing. He had come up with a few temporary pieces before we start shooting. And I would play them all the time on the set, everything while we were acting during dailies. And all my films basically have had music in them, and a lot of live music. And as soon as someone tells me you can't do something, it's when I do it. And on my first film, Welcome to L.A., which was about music to some degree, we did a lot of live music and dialogue at the same time, which sound technicians will tell you you cannot do. But now I've done it, and I've worked with the same sound guys for the last five films, and they get disappointed if we don't do that. Mm. But it's, for an actor, especially contemporary actors who have grown up as much on music as anything else, I find it's very, very helpful. And also, it seems that the worlds that the characters in my films occupy are not necessarily the real world, so to speak, you can't turn on the radio and be in the mood for one of my films. So music helps, again, define the boundaries and the possibilities.
In Made in Heaven, your new movie, Timothy Hutton plays a drifter. Once he's sent back to Earth, he becomes a real drifter. And there are drifters. There's a drifter in Trouble in Mind. There's a drifter in Choose Me. Did you ever see yourself as that kind of character, or do you strongly identify with a drifter?
I always liked that group in the 50s, the Drifters. Well, I don't know, you know. I'm not afraid of too many things, but one thing I'm not too comfortable with is analyzing how I fit into all this.
Right.
Somebody pointed out to me once that, do you realize that most of your films start with people either coming or going into a place? And I thought, well, no, but I'll take credit for it if it sounds intelligent, you know. I think maybe in this crazy existence of ours, moving around and trying to find something might be the most worthwhile occupation. I was talking the other day with somebody. Can you imagine being 12 years old when most of your human tools are on the table, ready to be used for the first time, and you become aware of your sexuality and the sexuality of others and society and accomplishment, and then 8 years later you're 20 years old when you've basically done everything you're going to do at least once, and now you're going to spend the rest of your life redoing it and refining it or blowing it. And now imagine doing all of that during the last 8 years of this president, and what that means to the stimulants that you've encountered in your life. And I think drifting and searching during this, especially during this last period, is almost essential for some kind of enlightenment, because you're certainly not going to get it in any of the political, economic, or cultural fallout of these times. And I don't know. I don't know if that reflects anything about me, except that I've been living a rather unreal life for many years now. I mean, I seem to always go the opposite way of traffic, and maybe that's why there's nobody ever goes to the movies. I don't know. But I think the search for something in America is as part of being an American as anything else.
You know, I really hope that you don't find this overly psychological or Freudian, but I feel like I should bring up here that your father directed the Donna Reed Show. Your father was a director. And that show was really, for so many of us who grew up in the 50s, like the example of what the perfect family was supposed to be. And, I mean, you've really so much departed from that suburban view of the perfect life.
Yeah, well, my dad did a lot of shows in the 50s, 60s. Donna Reed, Ann Southern, My Favorite Martian, Batman, all that. And I think I don't know if it was the times or if it's just genetic, but I think you basically rebel against your parents even if you love them, which I do. And everyone says, oh, you got in the movie business because of your father, but basically I so little identified with what he was doing that I actually thought I that would be the last place I wanted to be. But then my brother had got me a Super 8 camera when they first came out. He got it in Hong Kong, and I started shooting my own little movies, and it seemed to be the one language I understood. But my dad sees my films and, you know, he gives me this kind of odd look and said, you know what, a little chase scene would be really good, you know? But, I mean, he's proud of me, but he's not sure why.
did you grow up in Los Angeles
or in the area? Isn't that an awful statement?
but your movies are so urban to me, you know? And I figured maybe you grew up really, really yearning for the excitement of a city.
Well, yeah, I don't really get Los Angeles. I never have. Welcome to L.A., people who didn't respond to or upset because it wasn't a travelogue, you know, of Los Angeles. We never really occupied any of the highlights, so to speak, of Los Angeles. But when I was a kid, we came to New York, and it was the first time I'd been out of the city, the non-city of Los Angeles, and into a real city. We drove across country. I was about 7, 8. And my dad was working here, and we stayed here for many, many, many months. And it was in the 50s, and it was at a time when it was really that fairy tale version of the big city, you know, New York in the 50s. And that was as an impressive an event as has happened in my life. And maybe it's good that I never really got to live here completely, or never got to be raised in a place where it would rain all the time, which is what I really love, because it made me yearn for that and probably gave me a good degree of dissatisfaction to keep me searching.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but when you were growing up, were movies really magic for you?
Never saw a fade-in I didn't like, and I still feel that way. But the interesting part of it all is I'm not a necrophiliac. I didn't go to film school. I'm completely self-taught about these things. But, when you see a movie when you're a kid, you haven't a clue what the director does. I mean, don't even know what it is. And you just know that there's these big faces on the screen doing amazing things. I think the most influential movie I ever saw in my life was the original Invaders from Mars.
You know? I love that film.
I mean, I was a kid. The guy was a kid. It was all shot. I didn't know it at the time, but from a kid's perspective. And it was just ironic enough that it stimulated you, and I got it, or at least I thought I got it, because I'm only really interested in the things I don't understand. I figure the rest of it is all busy work. And
When you're watching the rushes of a movie that you're making, do you look for the same kind of magic that you felt watching movies?
Yeah, just watching dailies is the highlight of any shoot for me, and I invite everyone, and I play a lot of music. I have it hooked up through the screen, and every shot is always different. Every take is different, and I really do need that magic to encourage me to go on tomorrow. And, you know, as soon as you make a splice and start cutting, it seems to deflate the magic. But when a film works, the total is better than the parts, no matter how good they were. And that's the great thing about movies, is that the audience plays a lead role. And it's, I think most movies today ignores the audience. They go right for their popcorn buying potential instead of really for their emotional involvement. And I think movies are going to either pave the way to the future or keep us going in this cul-de-sac that we're in now.
Alan Rudolph, thanks so much for talking with us about your movies.
Well, thank you.
Alan Rudolph spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. His movies include Welcome to L.A., Choose Me, and Trouble in Mind. His new movie, Made in Heaven, opens this week. It stars Timothy Hutton and Kelly McGillis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Andrew Tobias. He's been called the Mark Twain of personal finance. He's a writer and lecturer on managing money. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Lara Lubavitch, the choreographer for Stephen Sondheim's new musical Into the Woods and the founder of one of America's top dance companies. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of pianist Jeffrey Jacobs performing works by contemporary Chinese composers. And Jan-Harald Brunvand tracks another urban legend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today, the United States, while not admitting guilt, expressed its regret about the death of an Indian fisherman in the Persian Gulf. The man died after a U.S. Navy frigate opened fire on three United Arab Emirates fishing boats on Sunday. State Department spokesman Charles Redman.
The United States regrets any loss of life, regardless of the circumstances. We extend our regrets to the Indian government and our condolences to the family of the Indian casualty, Mr. Bikwan Kamji. We have also expressed our regret to the government of the United Arab Emirates.
The Navy frigate was part of the U.S. force in the Gulf that is escorting Kuwaiti tankers through the waterway. Redman was asked whether the Navy opened fire because it believed the vessels were Iranian speedboats. He said he didn't have that information. A bitter anniversary in the United States was a day for celebration in Iran. Today is the 8th anniversary of the takeover of the United States Embassy in Tehran. Today in the Iranian capital, crowds marched to chants of death to America. The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament told one rally that this week all of the country's armed forces will mobilize to show the U.S. it made a mistake by sending its forces to the Persian Gulf. On board one of the U.S. ships in the Gulf, the USS Standley, Commodore Bill Kelly was asked what message he had for the Iranians on this anniversary.
No, I have no message for the Iranians. We've become accustomed, I think, we, the American public, have become accustomed to rhetoric of that nature out of some elements in Iran. I don't think it's necessary to respond to that. Our job here is to remain in a high state of readiness, and that's where we are today.
Today, the Defense Department announced that three more ocean-going minesweepers have joined the U.S. force in the Gulf. Their arrival brings to five the number of U.S. minesweeping ships in the waterway. NATO defense ministers today strongly endorsed the proposed superpower treaty eliminating intermediate-range nuclear weapons. At the end of 3 days of talks in Monterey, California, the NATO Nuclear Planning Group issued a communique praising the INF agreement and urging the U.S. and Soviet Union for progress toward an agreement cutting their long-range nuclear arsenals. More than 100 FBI agents conducted dawn raids in South Florida today, putting an end to what they say is the largest narcotics transportation gang in history. Jim Loney reports.
Agents called it Operation Beacon because of the high-tech radio beacon the Miami-based ring was developing to track shipments of narcotics they would toss into the ocean when in danger of capture. Members went by land, sea, and air and used a network of radio and radar to transport cocaine and marijuana from Colombia to the Bahamas and then to the U.S. FBI agent Bill Perry says the indictments have dismantled the gang.
It takes away the tools that they used, whether it be vehicles, boats, planes. It takes away cash that they used. It takes away real property that they used.
$5 million worth of property and equipment has been seized, including a dozen planes, 28 boats, and a ranch in Central Florida. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Loney in Miami.
Political tensions rose as budget negotiators failed again today to make progress on ways to cut $23 billion from the federal deficit. President Reagan said today the deficits are all the Democrats' fault. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole said the president should call administration and congressional negotiators to the White House to assure them that he really wants a compromise agreement. Stock prices posted modest losses today in heavy trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 18 points to 1945.29. Declines led advances 8-5 on volume of 203 million shares. Analysts say declines in the London and Tokyo markets and a lack of progress in budget reduction talks in Washington may account for today's losses. I'm Mara Liasson. This is National Public Radio News. in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album of contemporary Chinese piano music performed by Jeffrey Jacob. The titles of some of the pieces, such as The Autumn Moon and the Quiet Lake, or Three Melodies of Plum Flowers, come out of an Eastern tradition, but you'll hear that Western harmonies have also influenced the composer.
Jeffrey Jacob is a gifted young American pianist who specializes in contemporary music. George Crumb, Gunther Schuller, and the late Vincent Persichetti are among the distinguished American composers who have written for him. In 1982, he was invited by the Chinese government to make a concert tour of the People's Republic and became the first American to receive the Peking Conservatory's commemorative medal. His recent recording of contemporary Chinese piano music on the Redwood label commemorates that tour. The album is a curiosity, fascinating and touching as a cultural document, but only mildly appealing in its musical interest. To Western ears, Jacob writes in his liner notes, contemporary Chinese music is perhaps too familiar. He points out the peculiar irony that for the last 30 years or so, Western artists, and in music especially the minimalists, have been increasingly influenced by Eastern art, by what he eloquently calls those images of a timeless or changeless world forever recapitulating itself. Meanwhile, he says, Chinese composers seem to be most attracted to the very qualities of change, contrast, and progression that many Western composers attempt to deny. Unfortunately, what this boils down to is that for Western listeners, contemporary Chinese music is extremely conservative and derivative. You can hear Chopin and Liszt, Debussy, Ravel and Granados, Rachmaninoff and Prokofiev, or even George Gershwin and Jerome Kern. And though Chinese folk melodies and imitations of traditional Chinese instruments pervade the music, this folk element sounds about as authentic as the kind of chinoiserie that Debussy and Ravel and Puccini were bringing to European music at the turn of the century. Here's a bit of one of the livelier selections on the album, Wang Li San's Reminiscences of Er Ren Juan, a free fantasy using fragments of a folk tune whose title means Two People. Thank you. pianist Jeffrey Jacob playing contemporary Chinese music. These pieces are never less than skillful and charming, and Jacob is a warm advocate. He offers them the same sensitivity and genuine affection that he projects on his other recordings, his superlative performance of the Samuel Barber Piano Sonata, for example, on the British Redcliffe label. But even in the most ambitious selection on the album, Chu Wang Hua's Piano Sonata No. 1, which is dedicated to Jacob, there's little to engage a listener deeply. It's sad if these are the most exciting contemporary concert pieces Jacob could find in all of China, and I bet he looked hard. But they're all so mild, you might hear one as background music in one of the classier Chinese restaurants and not even notice.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed Jeffrey Jacob's recording of contemporary Chinese piano music on the Redwood label. Lloyd is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. We congratulate him on having just received his second ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for classical music criticism. This is Fresh Air. My guest is choreographer Lar Lubavitch. His New York-based dance company is in its 19th year. New York Times dance critic Anna Kiselgoff described the company as among the best in the world by any standard. Lubavitch is also the choreographer for Stephen Sondheim's new musical, Into the Woods, which opens on Broadway November 5th. This is the first time that Lubavitch has worked on Broadway.
Broadway itself is not a very interesting form to me. The Broadway musical comedy is not a form that draws me.
So what convinced you to do the choreography for Into the Woods?
Well, the fact is that the highest order of the day on Broadway nonetheless is Stephen Sondheim, and it is an honor to have been asked to work with him on this show.
Could you describe the style that you're working in for Into the Woods?
Well, to be clear about one point, there are no dancers in the show, and there is no dance in the show exactly. Mr. Sondheim is not a fan of dance, and he rarely, almost never has dance in his shows. He just quite plainly does not approve of dance very highly. And my job here was to evolve movement sequences for singers, singing actors. And while it can be called choreography to stretch the term, it is not definitely dance. I've staged the musical numbers for this show. Some of them are dramatic songs that story tell. And in a couple of instances, the singers, the entire company, do evolve into what is almost dancing, an expression of themselves as storybook characters, but not quite what you'd call a dance.
When you said that Stephen Sondheim doesn't much like dance, I thought there was an air of disbelief in your voice that it might be a little bit absurd for someone to not like dance.
It's a little bit absurd to use the word dance very generally and say you don't like it, because dance is a great variable in a variety of people's hands. And the plain fact is that Sondheim is not drawn to dance and therefore has not seen a great deal of the best dance that there is.
In the show, you're working with people who aren't dancers. So is there a certain colloquialism you're trying to get into the gestures?
Well, there's a certain direction that the show has taken since I've become a part of it, which has become more stylized and there is more movement in the show, if not exactly dance. The show was done in a full production a year ago in San Diego at the Globe Theater, and it was a complete production. And it was widely felt by the producers and people who saw the show that while the show was essentially very good, that it was somewhat static. And the producers prevailed upon Mr. Sondheim and Mr. Lapine, the author of the show, to collaborate with a movement person to imbue the show with more energy, with more movement, not dance, but movement, just to enliven the action. And so that was my responsibility.
What are some of the differences between Broadway and dance?
Well, for instance, dance is a much more abstract art, and we do not need to elaborate explanations in the course of making a piece of dance. The reason for a piece of dance is its sheer beauty sometimes, just the beauty to the eye or its relationship to the music. It need no explanation beyond that. However, working with actors, one must explain every activity which is requested by the director, which in this case would be myself. They have to be understand their motivation. They have to understand why at this point in the story they're moving that way, what it means to their character, what it means to the other characters on the stage. Very little is left to pass unexplained in the course of creating movement for actors.
Do you find that frustrating, that need to understand the significance of every gesture?
On the one hand, it can be carried to an extreme because occasionally the reason can be for the sheer beauty of it alone. On the other hand, this is what creates a very informed and fully fleshed out performance by an actor, is having this information associated with every move and every word that they make.
I'd like to ask you about some of your choreography for your company. You have a very beautiful piece called Concerto 622. It's a duet for two men that's part of the that's choreographed to the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. And it's a beautiful dance that's kind of about the interdependence and mutual support in any kind of relationship. What were you thinking about when you choreographed it? What kinds of images came to your mind?
What you say is exactly right. That is what the dance is about. And to put it more simply, it very simply is about friendship. And it's concerned with friendship in an era of dignity and mutual respect, mutual support. It's the adagio from full-length piece. It's the middle section. And it was in part motivated by the AIDS crisis, which is, of course, is upon us in full swing. And one of the themes, two of the emerging themes of the AIDS crisis, sub-themes, you might say, have been friendship and dignity. The friendship and the deep commitment shown by people who have taken care of their friends who have been unfortunate enough to have the disease, and the great dignity demonstrated to us all by those who have had the disease and have shared their information with us for our own well-being.
You thought of yourself as a painter before you thought of yourself as a dancer, and you thought that you'd be painting professionally and not dancing professionally. Is that right?
Mm-hmm, yes. And as a child and as I grew up, I'd intended to be an artist, and I did study painting and sculpting and went to college as an art major.
No, I'd read that about you, and when I read it, I wasn't surprised in a way, because there's such a terrific sense of form in your dance that it made sense that you'd have a painter's eye.
Mm-hmm. It does, indeed. And in fact, if I'm backed right into a corner about what I am, I call myself a movement artist.
Working with form.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start dancing later than most men do?
I started dancing quite late. I was almost 20 when I started dancing, which is considered rather late, but I had been a gymnast for several years before that, and so I was in physical training and adept at movement.
The impression I've gotten is that when you started to dance, you knew you wanted to choreograph. And that's different from a lot of other dancers who I know about who started choreographing after they had to retire from dancing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I did know I intended to choreograph. I was an artist by self-definition at that time, and I knew that the making of art was the most meaningful thing in my life, and that I wished then to make art out of movement, and that it was necessary to dance for several years first in order to learn what that was about.
You used to be a go-go dancer for a while?
I did that to support myself when I was a dance student in New York, yes.
Did pop dancing like that come in handy in your choreography?
Very definitely, because I was studying very disciplined forms of dance. I was taking classes in ballet and modern dance every day for several hours, and then I was dancing 6 hours a night as a go-go dancer in a popular Greenwich Village nightclub known as Trudy Heller's, which was there for many years. And I realized that I was having more fun doing the dancing at night than I was doing the great form, the great discipline techniques of the day. And I felt that I had to bring into my daily work the freedom and sort of primal enjoyment, primal force that I felt in my work at night. And so when I started choreographing, I was dedicated to making kind of dance that maintained that sort of primal urge about movement and didn't become a strictly intellectual or aesthetic endeavor only.
Are you working on new choreographed pieces now?
Yes, I'm working on a new piece right now to Francis Poulenc double piano concerto. And I'll be doing that and then getting another new piece done before our 20th anniversary season at City Center in March.
Now, do you choreograph because you know you have a dance performance coming up that needs a new piece, or do you just do it because you have an image that you want to work with? Do you need that deadline?
The deadline is a pretty good influence, scare tactics, you might say, to make me knuckle down and do it. I do need to choreograph because it's my work and it's my obsession, but I probably wouldn't deliver the goods quite as rapidly or as often if I didn't have the pressure of deadlines.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, and good luck with the opening and the rest of your performances.
Thank you.
Choreographer Lara Lubavitch. His company performs in Fredonia, New York on November 5th and 6th, and at Dance Celebration in Philadelphia on November 16th.
Listening to Fresh Air.
You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is co-hosting the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are coming up?
The commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission is testifying on Capitol Hill today. He's worried about the impact of future shocks on Wall Street. Also, a report on United Press International. There are resignations there. Financial turmoil at UPI becomes editorial turmoil. We also have a profile of an Estonian pianist, a man from the Soviet Union with a musical mission, and a look at the science of chaos.
They've turned making chaos into a science?
You thought it was journalism, but oh no. Actually, chaos has some very important mathematical patterns they've discovered. That and more later.
Thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Our resident urban legend expert, Jan Harald Brunvand, joins us today with another story he's been tracking. It's about food and suspicion.
Recently, my travel agent asked me if I collect funny travel stories. I collect all good stories, I assured her. Even if they might be true, she wondered. Especially then, I said. So she told me a story about an airline passenger and a Snickers candy bar, which she had been told by another client. The passenger, an older woman, was on her way from Salt Lake City to the East Coast and needed to change planes in Denver. She wanted a snack during her short layover, so she bought a Snickers bar and a cup of coffee and took them to one of those little tables they have near the snack bars. Because it was a busy time of day, she found herself sharing the table with a young man. She unwrapped the candy bar and took a bite, and to her amazement, the man then picked up the Snickers bar from the table and took a bite from it himself. Though angry, the woman said nothing, but she took her revenge by reaching over and taking a bite out of a donut that he had on a plate before him. Then her flight was called and she had to run. When she reached into her purse for her boarding pass, there was her own Snickers bar, still in its wrapper. As gently as possible, I told my incredulous travel agent that this was a very familiar story, and not just in our country. In England, where it was first collected in 1972, they call this urban legend the Packet of Biscuits. The scene is usually a train station. The man is a Pakistani, West Indian, or African immigrant, and he endures the insult in silence. The unwitting thief is an older, upper-class woman. English science fiction author Douglas Adams included the story in his 1984 book, So Long and Thanks for All the Fish, and he has retold it on talk shows, giving the impression that the incident really happened to him in London. In one of these versions, the woman has just left an assertiveness training class and is in the proper mood to take decisive action against the man, whom she assumes is eating part of her snack. Kit Kat bars have four segments, so the two travelers alternate in breaking off and eating sections. Such versions of the story are also found in Australia and New Zealand. The young man in these legends may be described as a punk rocker who maintains a stony silence. Other foods have also crept into this legend. In one Australian version, the two travelers in a cafeteria actually share a bowl of soup, taking alternate spoonfuls in angry silence. Only later does the woman notice her own original bowl cooling on the nearby table where she had placed it when she returned to the serving line for a spoon. English folklorists have suggested that what at first appears in the story to be polite sharing of food represents the ideal of full acceptance of minorities by members of the majority culture. But on another level, the woman's actual eating of the man's food reveals underlying resentment against outsiders encroaching into her country. The immigrant man behaves more civilly than the English woman, thus demonstrating what one folklorist called the patient and indeed saintly character of the often despised and rejected. There are even versions of the story in England in which the man carefully breaks his last biscuit in half to share it. As the story spread to the States and beyond, its emphasis shifted from the social or cultural differences between the two people to simply being about the confrontation of a man versus a woman and an older person versus a younger one. With the addition of details like airplane travel, a punk rocker, or an assertiveness training class, the story is made to fit perfectly into the current social scene.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Russell Jacoby. His new book asks the question, where are today's intellectuals? Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Cloud Nine, the new album by George Harrison. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Less Than Zero, the new movie adapted from the best-selling novel by Bret Easton Ellis. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.